Author Sue Miller has written a story collection, a memoir about her father and Alzheimer's disease, as well as 9 novels. Her latest novel is titled The Lakeshore Limited. For our series, You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love, Miller recommends a novel with a varied cast of characters, all of whom jump right off the page.
When Thomas McMahon, a professor of both applied mechanics and biology at Harvard University, died unexpectedly a little more than a decade ago, his legacy was voluminous. It included multiple scientific articles, the design for the track at Harvard, a handful of patents, including one licensed to Nike for a new kind of sole for a running shoe, and 4 entirely distinctive novels. My favorite among them is McKay's Bees. It's the kind of book which makes you want to sequester yourself away from the dinner table or the cocktail party when you encounter the rare other person who's read it, so you can compare notes on its many delights. Among them, its frequent hilarity, its occasional tender sexiness, and the sheer erudition on display within its pages. Do you want Darwin's theory explained in a few words? Why, it's about the greenness of every living thing, its sexual purpose, and its mortal nature. Do you want to know how to divide and multiply beehives? You'll find it here. How to build a small funicular to get you upstairs without electricity. How to make a daguerreotype, construct a kiln, all included for the price of admission, and all connected intimately to the foibles, the hopes, the aims, the character of the characters in this book. And what an assortment of characters they are. First, we meet the eponymous Gordon McKay, fat, industrious, wealthy, distractible, who sets out from Boston in 1855 with his new wife, 15 swarms of bees, and an entourage that includes a group of German music box makers and 2 alligators. They're headed for Kansas, where McKay hopes to make a fortune from honey. His wife, Catherine, is vain and passionate. She's married McKay in part to extract herself from her erotically charged relationship with her twin brother, Colin. Then there's the melancholic bee expert L.L. Langstroth, whose manual sets McKay in motion, the abolitionist Eli Thayer and his wife, and the naturalist William Sewell. John Brown makes an appearance here, too, and Louis Agassiz, and Presidents Lincoln and Pierce, all quickly made complex and human. To read this book is to be present at a strange moment in our nation's history, on the cusp of the Civil War, of the Second Industrial Revolution, which is where McKay finally does make his fortune. McMahon makes their preoccupations, their sorrows and joys so arresting that you can read this book 2, 3, 4 times, as I have, before you take in also the grand sweep of it. Of course, there's a narrative distance necessary to accomplish all this in so few pages, but it's not an ironic distance or a satiric one, though there's often humor in it. Instead, McMahon's tone here seems almost Chekhovian to me. It has that same gentle, rueful amusement. Witty, precise, tender, McMahon beckons us, as Chekhov does, to an enlarging generosity and wonder at all that is sad and funny and amazing in the world. You must read it.
Sue Miller is the author of many novels, including her latest, The Lakeshore Limited. She recommends the novel McKay's Bees by Thomas McMahon for our series, You Must Read This.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Federal regulators are reviewing the proposed merger between Comcast and NBC Universal. The Federal Communications Commission holds a public hearing today in Chicago. Few expect it to block the merger, but some hope regulators will impose restrictions to protect consumers. Joel Rose reports.
Once the proposed merger was announced, it didn't take long for the NBC show 30 Rock to start making fun of it. Here's how Alec Baldwin's character reacts to a rumor that the network is being sold to a Philadelphia company called Cabletown.
How could a company from Philadelphia buy a company from New York? That would be like Vietnam defeating the United States in a ground war.
But while NBC was sinking into last place among the major networks, Comcast was building an empire. company's gleaming two-year-old headquarters towers above the Philadelphia skyline. In a conference room on the 45th floor, Senior VP Joe Waz says consumers will benefit from the merger.
It's going to let the combined company bring the vision of an anytime, anywhere digital future to millions of Americans.
Waz is talking about the company's plan to offer video to its subscribers through cable and the internet. Since the merger was announced in December, it's drawn relatively little opposition. That may have something to do with the $3 million Comcast spent on lobbying in the first quarter of this year alone.
The company has also gotten letters of support for the merger from organizations like the Urban League and the Hispanic Federation. None of this surprises Harry Jessel, editor of the website TV News Check.
Comcast has been a pretty good corporate citizen over the years. They've donated money to things. They've supported things. When they have a deal like this and they need to call on community groups to say, hey, remember we did so-and-so for you, it's payback time.
The received wisdom in Washington is that it's a question of when, not if, the deal gets federal approval. But not everyone thinks it's good public policy.
It's a giant merger that's going to change the media landscape. I'm not sure that people are paying enough attention to it at this point.
Susan Crawford is a professor at Cardozo School of Law in New York who's writing a book about the merger. She says Comcast built its business on having must-see programming, including sports and news, that consumers can't get anywhere else. Now Crawford says the company wants to extend that model to the internet by controlling online access to NBC shows like 30 Rock and popular cable channels like USA and MSNBC.
The only way to get access to the programming you love, that you're addicted to, is to pay a monthly subscription fee. That may raise prices for everyone.
That could also mean the end of free ad-supported video sites like Hulu, because Comcast will insist that you pay for its content. Federal regulators can avoid that, Crawford and others say, by putting some significant restrictions on the merger. For one, they could require Comcast to show that it's pricing its programming fairly, and they could extract a promise that Comcast will treat all online traffic equally, a principle known as net neutrality. But Comcast VP Joe Waz says net neutrality doesn't need to be a condition of the merger.
We embrace the principles that the consumer should be able to go anywhere they want to go on the internet, should be able to use any applications they want. Net neutrality is the way we operate.
This is a company that has spent millions against net neutrality.
Ben Popkin is managing editor of the Consumerist blog. He's referring to the battle Comcast fought after it was caught 2 years ago, secretly blocking some of its internet customers from sharing large files. Popkin says that episode, along with the company's perceived reputation for poor customer service, motivated his readers to name Comcast the worst company in America earlier this year.
The history of this company says that the FCC would be foolish to not place some pretty strong contingencies on this arrangement.
Comcast representatives dismissed the Consumerist poll as a cheap stunt. The official public comment period for the Comcast-NBC merger is over, but the public will get a chance to vent at the end of today's FCC workshop. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
6 months ago, Haiti was rocked by a 7.0 earthquake that killed more than 200,000 people. It also left more than 1.5 million homeless and destroyed the capital, Port-au-Prince, and surrounding areas. Lots of Americans gave generously to charities helping the Caribbean nation deal with the devastation, from elementary schools donating pennies to rock stars reuniting for a remake of We Are the World.
Like Katrina, Africa, Indonesia, and now Haiti. They need us, they need us.
We are the children.
To date, Americans have phoned, texted, and mailed in more than $1.3 billion. Much of the money was spent on immediate relief, but hundreds of millions of dollars remain in the coffers of nonprofits such as the American Red Cross and Oxfam. NPR's Carrie Kahn has been looking into the charitable outpouring for Haiti, and she joins us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. Good morning.
So obviously there's still a lot of work ahead in Haiti, but it sounds like the fundraising effort has to count as a success.
Yes, the amount of money raised by American charities has been overwhelmingly deemed a success. The donations to Haiti almost equaled the money raised after the Asian tsunami of 2004. And remember, that money was distributed to several countries.
And I know you've been to Haiti four times since the quake, recently doing some reporting on whether these American charities are spending all that money wisely. Tell us what you found.
Well, if you talk to the charities, they say they're spending their money wisely, of course. U.S. charities legally only have to account for their finances once a year, and that's a tax time. So NPR producer Marisa Peñalosa and I sent questionnaires to a dozen groups working in Haiti, including the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and Doctors Without Borders. And we asked them about their finances and projects, and their responses are at NPR.org. And the response from Oxfam's spokeswoman in Haiti, Julie Shindo, was similar to what we heard from many aid groups.
I think the first 6 months' response has really been quite effective because we're not seeing these mass deaths. We have had a huge disaster here. The people are surviving.
And aid groups say there have been no major disease outbreaks. More than 1 million displaced Haitians have some sort of emergency shelter and access to clean water. And while in Haiti earlier this month, we could see that progress. But there are still hundreds of thousands of people living in overcrowded camps, in tents and under tarps. A miserably hot and humid way to live as temperatures hit into the hundreds and the rainy season is in full force. So one thing that's most striking from what U.S. charities told us is that many groups still have substantial amounts of donations in the bank. I ain't never gonna shut you up. Remember that two-hour telethon sponsored by stars like George Clooney and with performances by Sting and Beyonce? Surrounded by your embrace, Haiti, I can see your halo. You know you're my saving grace. The Hope for Haiti Now telethon raised $66 million. Yet it wasn't until last week that the charity announced it was dispersing the remaining $35 million. And the American Red Cross, which received the lion's share of charitable donations, raised nearly $500 million, but says it has only spent about a third. Like most groups, the Red Cross said it wouldn't have been prudent to spend all their money in just 6 months. And they plan to be in Haiti for several years. Peter Walker, director of the Feinstein International Center at Tufts, says that makes perfect sense.
The reality is, after a crisis like this, the ability of a country to absorb money and use it wisely really goes down.
Disaster experts point to wasted and redundant spending during the 2004 tsunami. Walker says the scope of the disaster in Haiti, with more than 200,000 deaths and nearly all government offices destroyed, makes a quicker recovery impossible.
Rebuilding in a country that's been devastated, to use that money wisely is actually quite difficult. If you think about it, a ministry's been destroyed, the people who would normally take decisions aren't there.
The government, which wasn't strong even before the quake, has been criticized for hampering Haiti's recovery. Rubble removal is moving at a snail's pace, and not enough land has been secured to build replacement housing. Foreign charities won't publicly criticize the government, but like Oxfam's Julie Shindel, they discreetly push the government to pick up the pace.
We want to see them there. We want to see them in the driver's seat, so to speak. And we know they're going to need help, but they have to take that position.
While aid groups may not criticize the Haitian government, the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee has no problem doing so. In a scathing report issued last month, Democrat John Kerry blasted Haiti's leaders for not taking a stronger role in the recovery. And Kerry had harsh words for the foreign charities, too, which he said need to better coordinate their efforts. I spoke with Haiti's Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive at his residence in Port-au-Prince. He says he agrees with many points in the report.
There is a total lack of coordination between themselves and between themselves and the government. We are improving, but it's a very slow, and at the same time, the problems are huge, and there is a lot of frustration. I believe it's the best word to describe the situation.
Bellerive says he's grateful for Americans' generosity, but he says the organizations distributing that money are too independent, and some are not informing the government about what they're doing. As it stands now, many of the larger charities have more money at their disposal than some Haitian government agencies. Donor countries pledged billions to Haiti, but to date have yet to make good on those promises. So, as in the past, the cycle of aid in Haiti goes on. Important development projects are bypassing the cash-poor, inefficient government and instead are being financed by foreign charities. Haiti's former Prime Minister, Michel Pierre-Louis, says her country cannot be run by aid groups.
Nobody knows to whom they are accountable to. How the money is spent, where it's spent.
Pierre-Louis, who runs her own nonprofit organization in Haiti, says there must be more transparency.
If you come to help, show us that you are really helping. That the Haitian people, especially the poor, the destitute, those that are the most need this help, are the ones really getting it.
So there is a lot of finger-pointing going on in Haiti now. Meanwhile, the situation remains difficult with so many people living in terrible conditions.
Okay, Carrie, fascinating report there. And I know tomorrow you're going to be back to tell us about the victims of this quake who are caught in the middle of all this.
Right, and we'll talk more about the bureaucratic snafus holding up plans to move thousands of these earthquake victims out of tents and to try and get them into more suitable housing.
Thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn. And if you go to npr.org, you'll find a breakdown of money raised and spent by a dozen U.S. charities now working in Haiti.
And in a ceremony yesterday marking the 6 months since the quake, Haiti's president pointed out some positives. René Préval noted that Haiti had not descended into widespread violence, as had been widely predicted, and that there had been no major outbreaks of disease. Préval was standing before the once elegant, now collapsed presidential palace as he handed out medals of appreciation to aid groups and some big names who've kept the spotlight on Haiti, including Sean Penn and Bill Clinton. Then came a torrential storm, which swept through a camp for the homeless outside the capital. Almost 100 tents collapsed in the wind and rain. A giant in the world of baseball died this morning. George Steinbrenner, the longtime owner of the New York Yankees and the man known as the Boss, passed away early today in Florida after what's being described as a massive heart attack. He was 80 years old. With us from New York is NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca. Good morning.
Hello.
And in a statement this morning, Steinbrenner's family called him a visionary and a giant in the world of sports. Pretty fair assessment, wouldn't you say?
There are a lot of adjectives you could apply to Steinbrenner, and they were all superlatives. He was driven. He was an egotist. He was a bully. He was a genius capitalist. He was demanding. He won 6 World Series. He created so much value for the Yankees and their fans.
The team's success, which was enormous, how much of it can be attributed to George Steinbrenner?
That's a good question, and I think it sometimes gets lost, because when George Steinbrenner bought the Yankees for $10 million in 1973, everything about the world of sports was less. The salaries were less. The price of tickets was less. And it wasn't seen that the Yankees were a great bargain then. Well, now the Yankees are worth over $1 billion. And one of the geniuses of George Steinbrenner, even though on the field he fired and hired 20 different managers in his first 23 years, he was always very focused on the bottom line. So he built that brand new stadium in the Bronx, and he created the YES Network to monetize everyone who was watching the game. And it's very attributable to Steinbrenner. Before Steinbrenner took over the Yankees, they were drawing fewer than 1 million people. He quadrupled attendance, all while raising ticket prices, sometimes to nearly astronomical levels. So George Steinbrenner's legacy lives on, not only with the financial health of the Yankees, but also every fan in Kansas City or Pittsburgh who says, why can't I compete in baseball anymore, has to look at the fact that George Steinbrenner was able to make his team so rich, and other teams maybe didn't have that management, didn't have that vision, just didn't have the means to do that.
Now, through all of this, Steinbrenner was not a universally loved figure. In fact, to be honest, a lot of the fun of watching him was to watch all the things that he did that made people mad.
Yeah. You know, he was an icon of the 70s. He hosted Saturday Night Live, and his persona was that he was a driven guy who would fire everybody. Then in the 90s, he became a fake recurring character on Seinfeld, essentially with the same persona. Now, he took a little bit of a hiatus in between because he was actually suspended twice by baseball. When he came into the league, he had made some illegal contributions to the Nixon reelection campaign, and he served a suspension for that. And then later on, he really went off the rails a bit and hired a private investigator to dig dirt on one of his star players. And after that suspension, though, he came back and he mellowed, or at least he saw that the baseball team was having success without him. And that smart businessman that I talked about said, maybe I better back off a little.
He has not been in great health, but what at this point does his death mean for the Yankees organization?
Well, obviously, they'll honor it, and his sons are still running the team. But right now, the Yankees are actually in better shape than at any time in years and years and years. Now they just have everything going. They can trade for any great player. They have a number of great prospects. They're sitting atop the American League with young kids ready to contribute. The Yankees right now are the favorite to win the World Series again. That would probably be the best tribute to Steinbrenner there is.
Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Mike Pesca is speaking to us from New York about George Steinbrenner, the longtime owner of the New York Yankees, died this morning.